This is episode one of the Nothing Human podcast, Introduction to Three Powers of the Human Spirit.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to the Nothing Human podcast, a biblically informed think space for exploring and articulating all the ways we make or break sense of human experience. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. From my youngest days, I have been fascinated with categories of thought, those often unconscious filing mechanisms that invisibly populate our premises, direct our inquiries, and ordain our conclusions. Join me as we investigate and interrogate our assumptions in an effort to articulate a more cohesive understanding of human information within the superstructure of God's truth. All right, well, thank you for joining me today for my first episode of my own personal podcast. And I think I should probably tell you a little bit about what I'm trying to do with this podcast. This podcast is almost entirely for my eldest sister, Krista. It really is, because for a lot of years, I've been writing articles, and she's very gracious, but for a lot of years, she's been saying, you know, I like your articles just fine, I get through them, but I much prefer just talking to you on the phone and hearing you explain these things in a more informal way. And this is true. I know this is true, and it's a weakness of mine. When I go to write my articles, I tend to over-edit, over-refine, and over-condense them because I kind of write for myself. And I'm sorry, it's a defect I'm trying to work on. But she just says, you know, your ways of thinking and your ways of explaining in more informal ways when we're talking on the phone and such, I just like those so much. And so she says, you know, will you do a podcast? And she's actually been asking me to do this for a number of years, and I, for various reasons, haven't gotten around to it until now. So the point of this podcast is to deal with what I would consider invisible assumptions that people make that in categories that will affect the direction of their thinking. It's almost like preconditions for rational thought that affect the ways we think about things and the conclusions we're able to make. And I'll just give you an example, because you may not know what I'm talking about at all, and that's fine. Most of us don't, because most of the time we don't make explicit what we think is obvious, because why would you do that? Everybody already knows those things. And so I think that one of the original sorting sorts was Thomas Aquinas. I'm sure there have been many before, but he's just kind of the exemplar for me, where he just wasn't willing to let even the most basic of questions go unexplained and defined. And he was probably following after Aristotle and that, who did similar things. I remember reading Aristotle on motion and just going like, wait, are you actually just talking about like what an object is in space? Like, everybody knows what an object is in space. But as soon as you start describing it, all of a sudden you're like, wow, this is a lot more complicated than I thought to actually nail down what we mean by these things. And it was a good exercise, even if a bit tedious. And Aquinas just went in that same direction. And I resented them for their tedium and the dryness and boredom that I experienced while I was reading them. And yet now here I am doing something similar to all of you. And I hope that it's useful to you and that you enjoy it as much as my sister has. So that's what we're doing here. Let me give you an example. So there's a concept that looking back into early Western thought has been called the Great Chain of Being. And basically, the Great Chain of Being is this idea that draws from Platonism, but particularly Neoplatonism with Plotinus, that good, and even a moral good, begins with God as the originator of all goodness, and that as it steps down from God to the angels, and then from the angels to human things, and then from human things to earthly living beings, and then from living beings like animals to inanimate objects and other material things, and then below that to nothing, which they considered to be what evil was, That was the great chain of being. Now, they pretty much assume this after, you know, especially with Augustine and beyond, this is pretty much an assumption that's made, that the definition of evil is as a deprivation of good, that, and this includes even moral evil. And that's just an assumption. They don't often explicitly talk about it. They just assume this, that evil is the deprivation of good because great chain of being. And they just assume that this is the reality. Now, when you look at the writings, again, when they're not explicitly stating this, some things can be really puzzling. Like, I don't know if you've read Augustine's Confessions, but in it, he tells a story of stealing some pears from a pear tree. He's a young man. He's hanging out with his friends. They're up to some mischief. They go to a neighbor's pear tree. They pull some pears off. Apparently, they eat a couple, but they weren't particularly hungry. And so eventually, they just take pears in order to throw them to the pigs. And he looks back at this story, and apparently it has puzzled him. Ever since he's become a believer, he looks back at this, and his motivations have puzzled him. He can't figure out why he did this. Because if moral evil is just the deprivation of good, and that, you know, moral evil in some ways is just some attempt to get good that's not permitted to you. Well, in this particular case, there was no good end in mind. It wasn't like he stole the pears in order to eat them because he was hungry, which even though it wouldn't have been permissible, at least it would have been understandable. But instead, he's taking the pears in order to throw them to pigs, which seems like just an absolute perversity, right? And so in this perversity that he's feeling, this perversity that he's detecting, he's just puzzled because of the great chain of being. This doesn't make any sense. What good was I trying to get? Because evil in itself is not something to be pursued, because evil in itself is nothing, which he thinks because he assumes the great chain of being. Modern readers, contemporary readers, looking back at that, are probably thinking a lot of things, but at least one of them is that Augustine is puzzled for no real reason, because most contemporary readers don't have as much of an issue with this idea that sin is a thing, that sin is not the absence of something, but that sin is actually in itself something to be pursued. That in itself is a different assumption, but you can see how we could be a little puzzled looking back at his puzzlement and saying, what's the deal with Augustine and why is he so obsessed with these pears in this story? So that's just one example of unpacking how an invisible thought category, invisible categorical assumptions, actually define and direct the kinds of questions that you ask and the kind of conclusions that you can come to. So there's a lot of these. These happen all over the place. I tend to find them a lot for some reason, and I think it's because I'm really curious about the assumptions and invisible categories that people use in order to come to conclusions. And God gave me that curiosity. I'm thankful for it. And because of that, there are a lot of interesting things that I find, or at least they're interesting to me, and I hope they're interesting to you. So today, I want to talk about what I think are some of the most important categories that I've found very useful in so many different areas, and they are the three powers of the human spirit. Now, this is not my idea. This is an ancient idea. It was extremely implicit in the thinking of most of the ancient Greeks and Romans, and was pretty much implicitly held to be the case by most people until very recently. And I think it was actually around the time of the Reformation that these categories started to get broken down, kind of thrown away. I stumbled upon them because I was writing articles on various different topics. One of them was the conflict between feelings and reason, because I was awakening to the power of the affections. And so I started thinking, you know, affections are on this one side, and they're being given a bad rap by a lot of Christians. And then intellect is on this other side, and it's given a pass by a lot of Christians, even though sometimes it's very destructive. And so I wrote this article called How Christian Rationalism Turned Me Into a Psychopath. One friendly commenter told me that I was actually sociopath, not psychopath, because it was learned or environmental behavior. But nonetheless, Psychopath worked well enough to get people to click on the article, and a huge number of people that I didn't know, strangers, for the first time, were reading my thoughts and saying, wow, this really matches my experience as well. And that was gratifying, but it was also terrifying because I thought I was just part of this, you know, backwater niche of reformed community where I had had my feelings abused into the dirt. And I assumed that other people maybe didn't have that same experience because they didn't have the same extreme environment. It turns out that it was a major issue all over the country, apparently, and maybe even all over the world within the reform community. So I was like, well, that's interesting. I need to write more about the affections. So I started doing some inquiry into that. And as I do some inquiry into the affections, I ended up writing an article about the difference between affectional Christianity and volitional Christianity. And I'm thinking, and I called it, you know, are you an ought to or a want to Christian? And I talked about the differences between doing what you thought was right because you thought you ought to do it and doing what you thought was right because you wanted to do it. And I, you know, there are pros and cons on both sides of that. So whether you're a will-oriented or an affectional-oriented Christian, I thought neither of those was necessarily wrong or right. But both of them needed to be discussed and distinguished and understood. So I wrote that article, and as I continue thinking about all these different ways in which these various powers of the spirit are opposed to one another, I started thinking, you know, there really are three powers. There are these three faculties: the mind, the affections, and the will. And as I discussed this more with my friends, they were thinking, wow, this is a really powerful set of categories to think about so many different things about human behavior and human personality. And I was thinking, yeah, it really, really is. And I was feeling really proud of myself. And then I went and, you know, as I was thinking about it more and more, I started finding this category distinction everywhere. And in ancient sources, as well as contemporary sources. And I'll give you a few examples just to let you know. So I was studying the categories of rhetoric, the ancient Greek, education of persuasion. And they would educate people in rhetoric, and you'd have three modes of persuasion. And listen to these three modes. You have ethos, pathos, and logos. So you look at these three things. Ethos, like ethics, having to do with the will. You have pathos, like pathetic, having to do with feelings or emotions, affections. And then you have logos, you know, logic, having to do with the mind. It's having to do with the word or mind. And so you look at those three and you're like, wow, the ancient Greeks also distinguished these three powers. And that was why there were three kinds of persuasion in their rhetoric. And then, you know, I'm reading in St. John of the Cross. I wasn't reading. A friend of mine, Joel, sends me this quote from St. John of the Cross where he's basically saying, you know, since we know, of course, everybody knows that there's mind, heart, and soul. And I'm like, wait, what? Everybody knows this? And then, you know, you can read it in Aquinas, of course, as he sorts through the three powers of the soul. And then, you know, you see it all over the place in all sorts of writers. Even, you know, recently I was just reading a J.I. Packer's introduction to some book on the Puritans. And in it, he just says, in passing, since the Puritans knew, kind of like all of us know, that the human has, mind, heart, and will. And I'm like, wait, what? Is this a thing that everybody knows and just hasn't been talking about? And so, you know, whether ancient writers, contemporary writers, this is all over the place. And I was kind of blown away, actually, by how pervasive it was, but it was just not talked about explicitly. It was, again, one of these invisible assumptions, these invisible categories. And so I started thinking, you know, it would be really helpful if somebody in a contemporary context were to discuss this. And so here I am. And so I promised that this would be biblical. So I'll tell you, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the biblical distinctions that you can find that actually map onto these three categories really well, actually ridiculously well, so well that when I first found them, I was like, wow, that just makes so much sense. So let's get into describing the three powers. And before I describe the three powers, I'll just say them again, that they are intellect, affections, and will. And it's my thought, and I think that this is has been borne out from personal experience, but also everyone that I've talked to about these things has been able to be like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense concerning myself. You have people who are led first by intellect, you have people who are led first by affections, and you have people who are led first by will. It's really important to know that does not mean they don't have the other powers, or that there isn't some overlap between the powers, or that, you know, objectively or absolutely, their powers are low if they aren't led by them. Because a person could have extraordinary rational intellectual capacities and also have above average capacities in feeling and or affections and in will. So it's not necessarily the case that these are absolute things. They're more like relative things to the person and in the community that they're in. But I do think that every single person has one main faculty that's sort of the buck stops here faculty, or the buck stops here power. Or in other words, what I'm saying by that is that in the end, if there is a conflict between the powers, which we'll talk about, there is a power that kind of has final say, right? So when you're talking about mind, heart, will, what this would mean is, if you are a person who is led by the mind, who's led by the intellect, it means the most important question for you is, what is true? If you're a person who's led by the affections, the most important question to you is, what is good? As in, what is pleasing? If you're a person who's led by the will, the most important question to you is, what is right, or what is righteous? Okay, so when we look at this then, that means that, just for instance, if you had a question about whether or not something was good, or whether or not something was right, or whether or not something was true, if you were led by, let's say, the affections, and let's give a particular example, like the issue of abortion. I see a lot of people arguing over the issue of abortion from multiple different powers. And they don't realize that they're arguing from different powers of the spirit. And so they're kind of arguing past one another and not actually dealing with the issue at hand. For instance, let's say a person is led by the affections concerning abortion or pro-choice issues. I would say that most pro-choice people are led by the affections on these things. And what they say is that it would not be good for the life of the mother. Notice that when you're talking about goodness, pleasure, convenience, life, that you're talking about issues of affections. So they say this wouldn't be good for the life of the mother. Further, they don't even think it would necessarily be good for the life of the child for it to be born into the world. And so because of the good that you can do for the life of the mother, and even perhaps preventing abuse or destruction from this child, you know, this is the better option, the more pleasing, fitting, or appropriate option. Now, a lot of people will come in and talk to these people, and they'll say, actually, you know, it doesn't matter about the benefit or good of the mother. What matters is that this is wrong. This is not right. Now, notice that these people coming in are actually addressing this issue from the will, from the power of the will, what is right versus what is wrong. And so a lot of times these people are talking past one another, because the person who thinks that it's wrong, as in immoral, doesn't care whether or not it is good or not good, or to what degree it is good or not good. That's not really what matters first. But the other issue is that the affectional person doesn't really care as much whether or not it is right or wrong, because that's a secondary issue for that person. And so they end up just talking past one another. Whereas it would probably be helpful, especially if you're a pro-lifer and you want to actually address this issue with pro-choice people, if in fact they're making the argument that this is for the life of the mother or for the good of the mother, it would be helpful to actually discuss whether or not that's the case. Does it actually benefit mothers? Let's look at all the women who have gotten abortions. What percentage of them regret having the abortion later in their lives? And it's a very large percent, actually. A huge percentage. Now, there are obviously a small percentage of women who say, I don't regret anything. And perhaps there's reasons you could investigate why that is. But the vast majority of women who have abortions actually regret doing it later on in life. Or let's say another question, how many people who didn't have abortions, how many mothers who didn't have abortions regret not having an abortion later on in life? Okay. Now, this has more to do with whether or not it actually benefits the mother in the end, and not so much as to whether or not it's right or wrong. Now, I'm not saying that the question of whether or not it's right or wrong isn't important. What I'm saying, if you're trying to persuade someone, persuade them in their lead faculty. Okay. So let's describe the three powers quickly. And then we'll be able to discuss a little bit more about the biblical mappings between the three powers and the Bible. Okay, so first, mind, intellect. I want to say this is not smarts. This is not smarts or IQ. You know, computers have the capacity to recall information. Computers have the capacity to obviously compute. They are computers after all. And yet we would not necessarily call a computer rational or reasonable. Or even intellectual. In fact, computers are really stupid. They can't even tell the difference between a picture with a, you know, stoplight in it and a picture without a stoplight in it. They don't really make much distinction between things. They do exactly as they're programmed to do. So I wouldn't consider recall or computing power to be the intellect or the mind in a human sense. It's not a spiritual capacity. That's a mechanical instrument. Now, it is still useful in the operations of the mind. I'm just saying that when I've had these discussions with people, they seem to be confused on this point. They seem to think that this person, oh, must be led by their intellect because he or she is so smart. And I'm like, well, that's not what actually is the mind when it comes to the human spirit. That is a mechanical material instrument of computation and recall that may or may not have anything to do with understanding or insight, which is what I really think is the power of the mind, understanding, insight, the capacity to take information and to draw between those pieces of information to make meaning. So it's meaning-making that makes your mind what it is and makes it human, a human mind, and not just a mechanical or computational object. And so now, obviously, again, if you have the capacity for recall and you have the capacity for high-level computation or processing, that's, of course, going to be useful even in understanding. Because if understanding takes into account a huge amount of data and tries to, you know, see the forest for the trees, well, then obviously the ability to hold in your mind a huge amount of information or knowledge is going to be helpful in that process, but it's not necessary for that process. In fact, if you think about, you know, how there are numbers of chess masters who, even though they weren't able to compute every possible, direction that a game could take in a chess game, they were still able to beat computers and still beat computers occasionally, even now, even with all the computational power that computers have in such a limited and finite rule set, simply because they're able to distinguish between good and bad choices. And they discard bad choices with hardly without even any thought. Now, this is, again, discernment, insight, understanding. It's something you can't really get computers to do at this particular point, and probably won't ever be able to get them to do. And so that's what mind/intellect is in as it concerns the human spirit. And it's important to distinguish that from smarts and IQ. When it comes to the next power, that's heart or affections. This is not emotions as such. Again, so this is kind of another issue that people, when they think about affections, they think about like overflows of passion. And I would say that emotions are the effects and the confirmations of affections, but they're not actually the affections. Aquinas would have distinguished between the affections and the passions. And we'll talk about that a little bit more at a later episode. But so what is the affections? Basically, it is your taste. And I don't mean just your taste sensibly. Again, this would be distinguished just in the way that we distinguish the mind from the brain, the understanding from the computational processing. We're going to have to distinguish the affections from your physical taste, your spiritual taste from your sensible taste. Obviously, they're connected to one another in the same way that the mind and the brain are connected, but they are not the same thing. And it's important to understand they're not the same thing. Basically, your affections is, you know, how you determine good from bad. I'm even willing to say how you determine good from evil, although I would say that evil and good are material in this case and not moral. So that's important to make that distinction. And again, I'm going to talk about that in a later episode because it's a really important issue when it comes to the affections. And then the last of the three powers would be the will. Now, again, this is not will power as such, or even bodily discipline or habit. This has to do with the ethos or convictions that a person has that directs them in the question, what is righteous? What is right and what is wrong? What is permissible and what is impermissible? And the will determines that. And obviously is connected to the willpower and bodily discipline and the ability to do what you think is right. But it's not the same thing in the same way that the affections are not the same as the passions and the mind is not the same as the brain. And if that all that makes sense, then we can move forward and I can talk a little bit about how these three powers actually map over biblical categories. So let's look at these biblical categories. There's a large number of them, and this is fascinating to me, because as soon as I started seeing this, I was like, wow, this is opening up a whole lot. For one, let's talk about prophet, priest, and king. Now, it should be pretty clear to you that the king would be the master of the will. Because he's the one who directs everybody in what is right and what is wrong. He is the judge between right and wrong. He's the one who determines and is the standard bearer and the standard applier for righteousness and law, right? And so the king is obviously the master of the will. The priest, in this case, would be master of the affections. He tends to the life. He tends to healing of wounds and the ministrations of life and goodness and blessing versus cursing. This is the work of the priest. The work of the prophet would be, generally speaking, the work of the word, the logos, which would also be the work of the mind and understanding and the declaration of that understanding. Okay, so that's prophet, priest, and king, which you see all throughout the scriptures, this distinction. I will point out that Jesus himself is the prophet, priest, and king. And in John, he says that he is the way, the truth, and the life. Now, if you look at way, truth, life, you can see that way is a direction of the will, truth is a direction of the mind, and life is a direction of the affections. And whether or not you pursue Jesus from your will first, from your affections first, or from your mind first, you're going to be pursuing Jesus, and you're eventually going to be better developed through Jesus and your community of brothers and sisters in the way, truth, and life. And so there's that. And you might wonder, since there's three powers of the human spirit, why maybe would that affect or connect to the Trinity? Well, I think it does. I want to be careful here because these are distinctions and not separations. But there is three persons in the Trinity, in the Blessed Trinity, and at one nature. So they are fully in accord. There is no contradiction or conflict there. But I do think that it's important to note that the will is almost always connected to the Father. In fact, will of the Father is a commonly repeated phrase. When the Son was here, he says, I do the will of my Father. I speak the words my Father has given me. And so this idea that, you know, I obey and I submit to the will of the Father is something that is clearly within the Trinitarian community. That the Father is, in some sense, the source of the will, that the others apply to and of course, agree with. The Son is known as the Word, the Logos, right? I mean, which again, it's like, well, of course, then the Son would be, for the most part, that representation of the will in word, which is a declaration or communication of meaning, of understanding. And he is the understanding, both in his taking on of flesh and also his declaration of the Father's word. We hear in this not a different word, but nonetheless the communicator of that word, and in some ways the mind. And we hear this, the mind of Christ. Paul is constantly talking about these kinds of things that, you know, put on the mind of Christ. And then you have the Holy Spirit, which is the only one of the persons of the Trinity, which is actually referred to by a feminine noun, a feminine pronoun. In the Old Testament, you see this because ruach is a feminine noun. And so sometimes when the pronoun is applying to the Spirit, even from the beginning of Genesis, when you have the Spirit hovering over or nesting over the surface of the deep, the tahom, that marhefet, the word for nesting or rustling or hovering over, is a feminine participle. And so you look at that, and even from the beginning, you have this nurturing, comforting quality to the Holy Spirit, which is very much connected to the affectional life and the life of the priest, the ministration of healing and comfort, which is, you know, in many ways has just a lot of feminine overtones for all the reasons you would think, because generally, not specifically, but generally, women tend to represent that quality of God in a way that men do not. And that is why God made man, male and female. In his image, he made them. And so this quality of you know, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that community is then represented in the human community. And there are, in a sense, I mean, this is a way of speaking, so forgive me if this feels like a little bit of a simplistic view, but there are sort of Father Christians, Son Christians, and Spirit Christians. And that's not to say that they're in exclusion or separation from the others, okay? That's really important, because it's only in community that they actually represent the harmony of the Godhead. And that's why Adam, even in the Old Testament, which is sometimes translated human or humankind, but also is a singular noun referring to the man, Adam, who was the first man, you know, this kind of idea between the singular and the plural is held together in this word Adam, and is used throughout to indicate the singleness and the plurality of humankind as a representation on earth of the heavenly reality of the blessed community of the Trinity. And so, of course, if there is within humankind this interrelationship between the three faculties of the human spirit in its various different configurations among individuals as they live together, well, then, of course, you would think that there would be within the Blessed Trinity a sort of higher and almost source of that being, which has those same kind of contours and is represented in humankind. So I find that really just fascinating. When you start to see invisible categories like this, it's possible to start seeing them in places where they actually are not. So just because there are things in the scriptures that are put together in threes at times doesn't mean that they're supposed to be connected to either the Trinity or the three faculties of the human spirit or anything like that. Oftentimes they are, but I will warn you, and I will talk about this in a future episode. Again, I keep saying that. But for instance, the Hebrews viewed the human spirit less like a house with rooms and more like a stew with ingredients. And you can still detect a three-part distinction in the Hebrew Old Testament, but it's not Greek in its precision, Again, it's not like rooms in a house. It's more like ingredients in a stew, which sometimes the flavors get a little bit more interpenetrating, and it's hard to determine if the flavor you're getting is the beef in the stew, or the tomatoes in the stew, or the potatoes in the stew, or, you know, the spices and the herbs and everything else. It becomes more all together. And so it's important, for instance, in Deuteronomy 6, when you look at the Shema. The Shema is a little bit strange because it says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and sometimes translated strength. And so if you look at that, you know, heart, soul, and strength, and you think, well, is this one of the three-part, you know, distinctions where we can map, you know, mind and will and affection onto that? And you can't, and there's a reason why you can't. And that's because in the Hebrew mind, you have more of a stew and less of a house with rooms. So for instance, and this is really important, and again, I'm going to talk about this at great length, but the word for a heart in the Old Testament particularly is not always what you think it means. The semantic range of most Hebrew words is much larger than English or Greek. And so the word heart can mean a lot of different things in the Old Testament. It's lev or levav in the Hebrew. And it can mean a lot of different things. And it's important to, you know, not assume and project onto it your own assumptions from your own implicit categories, and instead kind of let it speak for itself within its world. The word for heart there, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your levav or your lev, when you look at that, you should say, well, what does that mean in the Hebrew mind? Well, it kind of does mean mind, but it can also mean affections, and it could also mean your volition or your convictions. It's really more heart as in the heart of a tree, right? So if you say like heartwood, you mean just the center. So in some ways, the heart is the center of the person, the ways in which the faculties actually overlap. And then nefesh, soul, is sometimes translated life. And so love the Lord your God with all your heart, which is kind of the center of the person, all your soul, which is in some sense the identity or the life of the person. And then the last one, which is translated strength sometimes, is actually an adjective. It's not even a noun. It's the word meod, which if you remember in Genesis, when God says that he looked upon the world and it was very good, the word in Hebrew there is tov meod, meaning good. Very, very good, right? And so tov meod, so it's that same word meod, which really just means very, but that doesn't make very good English. So if you look at it and you're like, you should love the Lord your God with all your center and all of your existence and all of your very, it's like, what does that even mean? And you could say your veriness or your muchness, right? So the idea of like your overflow with, even if you've got the essence and the totality and then in everything, right? So that's more what those three parts mean. And you can kind of tell that that's the case because, for instance, in Matthew, when Jesus quotes the Shema, that he quotes it more closely to the Jewish structure with just three different distinctions. But in Luke, which was written more for a Greek audience, you can see that it actually is four different. When Jesus quotes, and Luke is kind of translating what Jesus is saying for his Greek audience, he puts it in four categories and not just three, so that Jesus says mind, heart, soul, and strength. So mind and heart being the ways that Luke, for a Greek audience, distinguishes the kind of two major lobes of the Hebrew word lev or levav, which could mean not just affections or just intellect, but kind of a mixture of the two or the center of the person. And so for a Greek audience, which again, you can see that there's already a drift into a greater precision within the Greek audience than there had been in the Hebrew audience. And so Luke is feeling the need to say, hey, if I just translate this cardia, you know, for heart, they're going to think that the Hebrews mean the same thing by heart that they do, which is the affections. but they, or the passions, but they don't. So so I need to add, you know, nous, mind, to it as well, to give them, you know, this expanded idea, so that they know that the word labav in the Hebrew is kind of a bigger word than their word cardia or nous are, because those are more precise and more distinguished. So you can see how, like, it's just massively important to understand the context within the scriptures that you're dealing with, historically and otherwise, and not to project onto it your contemporary context or your contemporary invisible assumptions. And by talking about these invisible assumptions, I hope to help you as much as possible to make better categories and understand a little bit better how to read and think about this biblical data, if you will, this biblical information. So, thank you so much for listening to this first episode. And in future episodes, I'm going to be discussing a little bit more directly major issues and deep dives into all three of these powers, and discuss some various different ways in which they can be used, both in terms of understanding your personality, avoiding particular prejudices, and understanding other people and learning how to be more persuasive in the way that you live your life and the way you argue. All right, so thank you so much, and until next time.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.